The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. We are on iTunes under Writers on Writing. We're on Stitcher and other podcast platforms. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. We are here doing what we do each and every week, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft, their publishing process, how they're working and focusing during these kind of crazy days. So I get a fair number of questions from listeners about self-publishing, about small presses and how to market those books, how to win awards with those books, and the state of the world around those issues right now. So it's my pleasure to welcome Deborah Gall, a two-time expert in those fields, to the show today. After a career as an entrepreneur, business executive, and business coach, Deborah Gall turned her attention to the study and pursuit of writing. Her debut novel, The Dream Stitcher, was a finalist for the National Jewish Book Awards and won the Indie Reader Discovery Award for Literary Fiction. Her latest, Synchronicities on the Avenue of the Saints, came out this past August. Both books are widely available online, and it is my pleasure to welcome her this morning. Debbie, welcome.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Marie. It's a delight.
So before we dive into the book, I'll ask my favorite first question, which always amounts to, you know, how did a nice girl like you end up writing books? So basically, for a successful career in business, why writing?
Well, you know, it's weird. I enjoyed my career in business. That was, you know, most of my life was in business, and I felt like I had pretty much achieved what I wanted to, but I was very aware that within the business world, I felt that I kind of got caught up in this illusion of having power, so to speak. I was running a large company. People told me I was really good at it. I bought into this illusion of, wow, I was, you know, more, I was smarter than some other people in the company and all the fake things that I started to believe about myself. And I didn't like that feeling. I started to realize that. And I thought, I need to get off of this false belief. And so I just started to write. I started to write and I felt better and I felt more authentic. And I guess I wanted to embrace some things that I knew absolutely nothing about and embrace that, you know what, I could fail at it and then try again. And then maybe I could get better and then maybe I could fail at it. So for me, it was a way of calming down and getting to the core of who I really was.
You were in theater at some point before writing.
Yeah, well, so I had been an actor way back when, before my business career started, and I always felt a great sadness at leaving the world of theater. It's a kind of a heartbreak I never got through. So when I left the business world, I was, you know, again, I was looking to be more authentic, and I was looking to get back into creativity. And so I started taking writing courses, and I realized that for me, it felt exactly the same as acting. I could emotionally resonate with these characters. I was just making them up instead of reading a script, but I could take that emotion, turn it into words, and put it on the page. So for me, it felt identical to the way I felt when I had been doing theater. And that fueled me. It was very addictive. And so there you go. I kept writing.
Were you a writer as a kid, or was this, you know, were you, I assume you were a big reader all the way along.
I was always a big reader, but I wasn't a writer. I funneled my creativity into acting, and I always admired scripts and, of course, novels, of course. But I loved scripts, and it was intoxicating to memorize words, and I had such great respect for those people that could put words on the page. And I guess what I was doing in that idolization was wanting to, you know, emulate that myself. And I had to get to a certain age where I got other things out of the way. I got business out of the way. I raised children and kind of, you know, had those journeys. And now I had time to myself and I could emulate those people that I wanted to be like.
So there's a fair number or a fair amount of magical realism in both of these books. And it's just a wonderful texture. And I was wondering if that had always been an interest of yours independently, you know, in your reading, if that had been an interest, or if this just kind of seeped in sort of an organic way to the stories that you wanted to tell.
Yeah. So, you know, that's the crazy thing about this. I wasn't naturally wired to read stories that had magical realism in them when I was younger. I mean, there are certain authors that write magical realism that I dearly love and I think are amazing, and I would love to write as well as they do. They're more, you know, magical realism authors that are more literary. But honestly, I wish I could just write a simple story. I don't know why magical realism seeps in and won't let me go. And I end up writing these complicated stories that can't be told without adding either ghosts or shamans or reincarnation, things that are not necessarily mainstream, that a lot of people tell me are, you know, kind of a little bit woohoo. But that's just how I write. And I'm just very drawn to that. And for me, it feels like it's very much part of the real world. I have very vivid dreams where I am not on this plane. And I just make sense of the world by embracing magical realism.
That's what I was going to ask. This is more of a worldview for you than just a simple, you know, attraction in your writing. I mean, it really seems like this is one lens through which you view life, you know, not just in your fiction, but in real life.
It's true. I make sense of the world that way. So for instance, in Synchronicities on the Avenue of the Saints, that writing found me because I had an experience with a real life shaman who's actually a very learned man who's well known in his field. His name is Dr. Melodoma Somme. And I had experiences with him where he did divination. And I was given messages from the ancestors of things I had to perform in order to be on the path. And in the performing of those tasks, things would manifest for me in the real world that felt very natural, that somebody else might look at that and say, wow, that's really weird. I don't understand that. But for me, those were real things. So, you know, all I did was write about those magical experiences and put them in the real world.
Well, that's a great segue to allow you to take us into the book. And I'm going to let you kind of set the stage for Synchronicities and introduce us to Noah and Sally and their crew. And then we can dive into it a little bit further.
I was going through an experience with a family member who had bipolar disorder. And there's a lot of bipolar disorder that has gone through generations of my family. And in this case, I felt like I was going to lose this family member either to drugs or alcohol or suicide or just a state of crazy from which he'd never return. And I felt like I had explored, and he had explored, Western medicine to the extent that, and it wasn't helping him. He couldn't stay on medication. Hospitalization was only a help temporarily, and you know, he was very heavy on drugs during hospitalization. And so I started reading an alternative medicine book that described an African shaman, and in this case, Dr. Melodoma Somme, who had taken an 18-year-old bipolar patient to live with his tribe in Africa. And in his culture, he's from the Dagara tribe in Burkina Faso in Central Africa. And they believe that anyone who is mentally ill is actually a shaman in the making or a healer in the making. And because this young 18-year-old bipolar patient was perceived as someone who was revered rather than reviled, he healed. And he went back to the United States and he entered medical school at Harvard and became a medical doctor. He was, in fact, a shaman in the making. And I was very moved by that story. So I read all of Dr. Somei's books. He's written some marvelous books. Of Water and the Spirit is my favorite. And I happened to find out that he was going to be in Santa Barbara, about 2.5 hours north of where I live, and would be doing divination. So I drove up to see him. And during the course of that divination, I mentioned this before, but he told me things that I had to perform to be on the path. And I did those things. And not only did I learn to let go of my loved one's journey, he learned to let go too. And he got on a path and he healed. And it was a way, it sounds very strange, but through my journey of letting go, he also had a journey of being able to accept who he was, and a combination of staying patient and also accepting therapy and the right help to get through his disease and get on a path to be someone that would help society. So that was an experience that I wanted to incorporate in novel form. There's nothing in the novel that talks about this specific experience, whether it was this 18-year-old bipolar patient that I mentioned or my loved one that I mentioned. It's not the plot of the book, but it takes the theory of being able to let go in order to find mental health.
What year was your experience?
About 1998.
I only ask that because I think it's interesting to take something from real life and try and see how long it percolates in the creative mind to come out as something different, you know, how long that transformative process is of processing that for yourself and turning it into something new. And some writers can do that, you know, in a year, but I think generally it does take a couple of decades to sort of...
It does, yes. And in this case, it took me a very long time for that to percolate up. And it was a decade of writing and then far more, you know, at least 5 or 6 years of sitting. I had to sit with the book for a long time to get it to make sense and be where I needed it to be or where it wanted to be before I could bring it out.
Right. So this book was actually written or worked upon before The Dream Stitcher.
It was. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's always an interesting thing of putting a book away. And there's a risk of that. I mean, sometimes you put it away and that's the last we all see of it. And so there was obviously something about this that you knew.
So I did put it away. And honestly, there was a point in time where I thought, you know, maybe this should never see the light of day. It's a different kind of story. But there was something about the story that wouldn't let me go. And I thought that the world needed the story, that it was a story about, for me, it felt like a story about healing the world, not just this one person. But it was a story about joining modernity with indigenous culture as a way to heal the earth. That big picture is what the story is about. And I really wanted that out there in a time that is so dark and so dense. And I mean, there's just, you know, so many issues to deal with. And not that this is a book that's really going to make a difference, but if it made a difference to one person, then I thought that was important.
Right. And I do think it's interesting to, and I don't know how much of this played in your thinking about bringing it back out, as you say, where the world has gone in the last, you know, 4 or 5 years. I mean, if you had written this in the 50s, you know, when things seemed kind of happy and positive in the external world, maybe it wouldn't have worked so well.
I think I could have written this book in the 50s.
For a lot of reasons. Yeah. Right. But, you know, I do think that the imbalance of where we find ourselves, regardless of where you find yourself on a political spectrum, I think we can all agree we've hit some sort of crazy imbalance. And you're right, that felt like the bigger message of the book.
Yeah, that's where the writing took me. You know, it's impossible to write. None of us write in a vacuum. And as I crafted the book, which, you know, has been crafted over a long period of time, it's why it had to sit. There was something that wasn't quite right. And I started to pick up on, you know, our world that has changed dramatically and tried to infuse that into the work of the book.
So without giving too much of the novel away, no hidden secrets, but kind of introduce us to Noah and Sally and the kind of the two storylines of the book. There actually are maybe more than two storylines of the book, but
yeah, I know it's a little bit of a complicated book. So primarily the book is about the journey of these two people, Sally and her son, Noah. Sally runs a pharmaceutical business and she develops a drug to help her bipolar son. When this book takes place, which takes place in the 90s, there was no recognition that bipolar was a disease that could affect children. It's probably only in the last, I don't know, 10 or 15 years that we recognize that somebody is born with bipolar disorder. It doesn't come out until their late teens or mid-20s, but you are actually genetically predestined to have that disease. So at the point in time that the book takes place, Sally develops a drug for her son at the age of 10, I suppose. And because she has a pharmaceutical company, she can do that. So her son at the time the novel takes place has been in this drug for about 14 years, and he's doing quite well on the drug. But of course, there are disastrous side effects that are about to come to light. And he is bipolar, but not only controlled by the drug, he feels very much controlled by his mother. And he finds out through a shaman that he meets that the drug has these side effects and that there's also something nefarious going on in a company that is trying to buy his mother's pharmaceutical company. So that's kind of the seeds of what gets the story going, as well as a backstory that takes place in 1918 during a pogrom in Russia, where a crime is committed against a ghost from that era. And she goes forward in time to get Noah to help her right a wrong that his ancestors committed in the past.
I called that the way back story. The backstory and the way back story.
Yeah, it is a way back story. It's only 100 years way back.
So it feels very carefully constructed. I know you worked on this. So it sounds like you worked on this for like 15 years from sort of first iteration to second iteration. And I know you call yourself a pantser. We have the outliners and the pantsers, and you have always put yourself in the pantser category. So I was wondering, you sit down to write it, kind of however it goes, you follow your intuition, but then, you know, it's complicated, right? I mean, there's all these storylines, there's a lot of characters. There's stories within stories. There's the way back story. So tell me a little bit about once you have, I don't know how many pages or words of raw material, at some point then it feels like you'd almost have to outline it to understand what the story is and to keep track of all of these characters. So I was wondering if you could walk us through that process.
So you would think that I would have to outline that and set that down very carefully. And the strange thing is that I don't. And it is crazy. Trust me, it is really crazy making for me. And I hope I can make some sense out of this for your listeners, because I don't mean to be mysterious at all. But I start off writing what I think is a simple story, and I let the story take me where it wants to go. I know that just sounds, I wish I could make more sense out of it, but that's what I do. I start off, I think I know where the story goes. I have an idea of some characters, and then the characters start talking to each other and they take me where they want to go. In this case, I started writing Hadassah's story. She winds up being really at the very beginning of the book.
She's the way back.
She's the way back story. And I wanted to put her later in the book and start off with just Sally and Noah's story and then bring in the way back story. But Hadassah would not let me go. She visited me in the middle of the night and she said, if you don't put me at the beginning of the book, I'm not going to reveal to you what happens at the end of the book. And because she is a witch, I was forced to listen to her. I'm really not that crazy. I'm actually not. This is how story unfolds for me. It's just so strange. And yeah, so I just...
But that's who she is in the book, too. So, I mean, it kind of makes sense. I mean, you're saying that it's crazy, but it really isn't, because that's who she is. I mean, she's a very forceful, overpowering character. And so as you're getting to know your characters, that's just part of who she is. So I say, you know, on you know, we're all sane here. It does make sense that she would come to you in the middle of the night and make her insistence known. Part of getting to know your character.
Thank you for looking at me like a writer and not a crazy person. That is really very helpful. And that's what good friends do, isn't it? Yeah, no, but I just keep writing towards story. And of course, not everything I write stays. You know, I'll write pages and pages and pages and I'll throw them out and maybe I'll only keep a couple of paragraphs of what I've written. But those few paragraphs that I keep fuel me for the next day's work. And I just keep inching that story forward until it has enough heft that it starts to take off on its own. And at a certain point in time into the writing, for me, it's about like 40% in, then I can just kind of gallop toward the rest of the book. Yeah, so I'm not sitting down and writing, you know, this scene is happening today and tomorrow I'll write the next scene. That just doesn't happen. And I think I've talked to you about this before. I'm a very meditative writer. So I light candles, I meditate, and I kind of read into the ether for what I think, for the story that I feel like I'm reaching for. I drag it down, I download it on my computer, and then I try to make sense of it.
Well, the reason that I ask all of this is because, you know, it's literary fiction, it's magical realism, but it's also, I mean, thriller isn't the right word, but
there is, you know. I know what you're saying there. There is a sense of very quick pacing.
Exactly.
Yeah. And the Dream Stitcher was quickly paced. I want the reader to have a feel that we're galloping toward the end of the story. I want them to stay with me and feel that rush. And I think that comes from the feeling that sometimes when I'm reading a literary book, there are some writers that get lost in description, and I don't want to do that. I want to have enough description to set the scene, but I want to focus on the pacing and that quick movement through it. Right. And that's, you know, that's what I want to read. And so therefore, that's what I want to write. And sometimes when I'm writing, and it's going to sound kind of crazy too, but it's an exhausting process for me. Like I have run around the block, or I've done, you know, an hour worth of sprinting. That's how it feels. I am really trying to rush through getting the story down, and then I'll have to go back and fill in the gaps that I know I missed to make sure that it's very clear for the reader. It's kind of an exhilarating race to get the pages down, because that's how it's streaming into my head. It's coming very quickly, and I have to capture those images very quickly before I lose them.
It's interesting you say that, because that is the experience for the reader too. And I think, well, one question is, I'm wondering if some of that comes from your love of scripts and script. You said you had a real appreciation for script and script reading, that, you know, it felt very cinematic.
I do. I've been told I write cinematically, and I think that was true of the Dream as well. I do think it comes from my love of scripts. You know, I'm not, when you read a script, it's just dialogue. The only thing that would be written down is, you know, the character enters the room, the character picks up a cup, those kinds of things that are mostly done by the director, but every blue moon, there'll be a little descriptive thing in a script, but it's all just dialogue. Not that I want the book to be all dialogue, because I don't, you know, sometimes the action takes place without dialogue, but it's got to be quick. I'm just trying to move the reader through those scenes to get back to dialogue, because that's where most of the character's soul is revealed, and most of the action takes place through dialogue.
Right. And the other effective, I always hate using the word device, but the other effective way of building suspension and momentum is by putting your characters on a time clock. And that happened a lot in this book, you know, that when you're looking for a way to build suspense or to get the reader's heart pacing, you put your characters on a ticking time bomb.
Right. Yeah. Noah is on a ticking time bomb, and the time bomb is about 3 days long. And so a lot has to happen during that course of time. And in a way, even though Hadassah's story is in the way back story, she's on a ticking time bomb too.
They all are.
Time is part of the theme of the book, and it just, you know, it has to drive the action quickly. So I'm glad if that worked for you. That's great to hear. because I was very conscious during the whole writing of the book not to bog down, that I had to be, every single character has to be under the gun, and therefore I, as a writer, had to be under the gun as well.
I also love the theme of memory, and I don't want to give too many plot points away, but memory, I think both in The Dream Stitcher and this book, you know, is a persistent interest of yours.
I do think I do ruminate a lot about memory, and I think I worry about memory a lot. My mother had Alzheimer's, although not until very late in life. I mean, I think she was about 87 or 88 when she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And so it's not like she had a tragic life. She had a very full life. And it was only the last decade, believe it or not, my mother lived to 97. So it's, you know, nothing tragic there. But I was very affected by watching that journey of someone that I knew so intimately to be vibrant and brilliant, have that decline. And so I think about memory a lot. And in the case of Noah, I wanted to give him a problem with memory or a fear about memory as somebody that was vibrant and young and only 24. What would that be like if you all of a sudden discovered that memory might be disappearing for you? So apparently it's something that's on my mind. I do worry about my own every once in a while. I think we all do. Well, you know, it's been interesting too, because during this particular point in time in the pandemic, and I'm hearing this from other people are beginning to worry about their memory. They have the sense that their memory isn't as good as it was before the pandemic started. And I think that's because our worlds have become smaller. We're not having as many conversations. We're not seeing, you know, many people. And so certain synapses, they kind of feel like they're drying up. So it's just been interesting to reflect on this story that I wrote pre-pandemic, but did some of the editing at the very beginning of the pandemic. I just think it's been an interesting reflection for me.
That's one of my favorite things to talk about writers, that the book that they wrote in a place and time that was different than the book is now coming out, and how many synchronicities there often are, you know, in the world that the book comes into versus the world they wrote it in. I always think that's really interesting. And it happens so often.
Yeah. Well, it's almost like the book tells you at what point it wants to be born. You know, right. You work on it and work on it. At a certain point as a writer, you eventually either just give up or, you know, I mean, that's just the way it is. You never can make it perfect. But at a certain point in time, I believe the book says, okay, enough. I want to be out there, even with some of my flaws there and affect the world.
One last question on the magical realism and the world building, because the thing that would strike me as hard, I don't write in that genre, but the thing that feels hard in that and sci-fi, any of these genres where you have to not only take the reader on a journey, but also explain the rules of the world to the reader without sounding didactic or, you know, this is how this works in this world.
Right.
And I wondered if that was tricky for you or if that also came about pretty organically.
Yeah. You know, so for me, that came about organically. You know, there's a difference in writing magical realism than there is writing fantasy or, you know, and some people will call my work fantasy, but it's really not. In a fantasy world, you do have to build a very clear world and there have to be very clear rules. But in magical realism, things that are not so ordinary can infuse the real world. And so those are the worlds that I build. A world where, for me, it's very real. I think that magical things happen all the time. They happen to me all the time. I interpret things as having meaning that maybe somebody else wouldn't. Which is what synchronicities are, assigning a meaning to something that might seem like it's not connected. So for me, it's a very real world that I live in. So I don't feel like I'm constructing a world. I just feel like that is the world for me. And I'm putting that down on paper and I'm giving it a plot. But I find magic in everyday living practically every day. So I'll just give you a simple example, only because it happened. It's been happening every night this week. And somebody else would interpret this differently. But there is an owl that is visiting my yard every night. So every night for the past 4 or 5 nights, the owl comes to me like at 3 in the morning. Now, I know why he's coming. We planted vegetables and there's probably rodents. That's why he's coming. But in my world, I assign meaning to that. You know, the owl is bringing me wisdom. What is he trying to tell me? What does he want me to do? You know, if he comes tonight, I'll probably go out in the yard in my nightgown and see if I can talk to him. It is taking something that is very ordinary, the visit of an owl into your garden. Somebody else might interpret that, oh, you know, I have vegetables, the owl's visiting my garden, period, the end. Not me. I interpret that as a bigger thing. There is a message he's bringing me. What do the ancestors want to tell me? Maybe I need to do a little research on the owl and dig deeper in this. That is the world I live in every single day. And somehow I am more comfortable in that world than I am in just accepting the real world as face value.
It's interesting because I talk to a lot of writers who have said variations on this same theme, which is, and I think it's an act of paying attention. And, you know, they tell me, just as you said, you know, that they'll have these experiences and they'll try to make sense of them. And then they'll see patterns and they'll see synchronicities. And they ascribe a larger meaning to it that I think is what separates the layman, you know, kind of bumbling through the day, as I do, and the writer who sees patterns and interconnections and makes something bigger of it, which would weave into a story. I hear that a lot. And I think it's a reminder, however you choose to view the world, to be open to things larger than yourself and to pay attention. I think it's an act of paying attention.
Thank you. That's a great way to describe it. And it is a way for me to try to connect to things that are larger than myself, which is what I think we all try to do when we write. You know, when you write, what you're really trying to do is get outside of yourself and see if you can make sense of your world in a larger context that then maybe somebody else can read and make context of their world themselves. You know, I think that's what we're trying to do as writers, or at least that's what I'm trying to do.
You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest this morning is Deborah Gall, the book Synchronicities on the Avenue of the Saints.
Were there any characters here that gave you pause? I know that you talk about having a family member with bipolar, which seems very different than trying to write from the point of view of somebody with bipolar and making that empathic leap into someone else's mental state strikes me as, you know, that could have been pretty tricky. So were there characters in here that were harder for you to access and how you kind of dealt with that?
Yeah. So for whatever reason, I felt like I really related to Noah and I really understood them and I understood him. And I think that's because I've had experiences with more than one family member with bipolar, and I'm very sensitive to that. And for, you know, and I'm sure my wiring, even though, you know, I've never been diagnosed as bipolar, I don't believe I'm bipolar, but I do think I have wiring that is sensitive in that way, if that makes any sense. So for me, I think that was easy for me to kind of get inside his head, and I hope I was able to do that correctly. It was easy for me to get inside Sally's head because in some ways she was reflective of my years of being in business. Not that I exactly had the experiences that Sally had. Thank God I did not, but I had some experiences that were a little dicey. So I felt like I could write her easily. I think the characters that were really difficult for me to write were the darker evil characters, you know, the psychiatrist. He was difficult for me to write. And I had a difficult time writing the chairman of the board.
Dalton,
thank you very much. It's amazing how you get out of the book and then you can't even remember the names of your characters. Yeah. Those characters were difficult for me. And I think the difficulty was that I didn't want to make I was afraid of making them one note, and I concerned that I did, because the flavor of the book for me took on a kind of a mythic flavor. And so that lent to kind of writing more mythic characters than real characters, so to speak. And I don't know if that makes any sense for you as the reader, but that's kind of what happened. So I know that it's possible I fell short on those characters, but they were elusive for me. That was difficult.
And I was going to make a comment about your years in corporate world and how that, you know, was so infused in the book and really gave it another air of authenticity of living years in boardrooms.
Well, and I think what I was trying to opine about by putting those things in the page was a little bit of what I described to you in the book or beginning of my writing journey, which is that I felt there was a false sense of power in the corporate world. And that false sense lent to an unsavory side of human character and human experience. So I wanted to at least bring that to light.
We talked a little bit about research for the book. You know, you mentioned doing a little bit of external reading. Was research a big part of the process here?
Well, yes, it certainly was in trying to be authentic with the shaman story. Jean-Paul Amon, who is kind of a combination of the real life Dr. Melodoma Somei and some other shamanic healers. I actually ended up working with Dr. Somei and he was doing a class for shamans in the making. I spent a week in the woods in Oregon teaching African divination and different ceremony. And so I spent a week and tried to infuse some of the things that were very real in those worlds into the book. So that was an area of research that I needed to do. I read a lot of physics books. I love to read physics. I don't understand except a small smidgen of physics and don't pretend to understand it. But I don't mind reading books I don't understand. So I read a lot of physics books so I could infuse Noah with those parts of his character. I had fun with that too, trying to make sense out of little that I might be able to put in his character. So those were probably, you know, those are the two areas that I spent the most time in research. Of course, I had to research a little bit about living in the shtetl, but that came more out of family stories than it did actual research of what happened in the way back world, as you say. I did have to research Fabergé eggs, but that wasn't very extensive. But that
would be fun. Yeah, that would be fun.
That was a lot of fun. I wish I had some.
It does feel like that the way back story would have potential to almost derail things because it's so rich and so interesting. And, you know, once you're back in that world, I could see being compelled to stay back there. But, you know, you struck just the right balance.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm glad. I'm relieved to hear that. Yeah, it is intoxicating to be in that world. Not that it's any happier than this world. There was nothing happy about that way back world. It was a pretty daunting time. But I do apparently like writing about historical things that happen. So it's just a bent for me.
One more question before we turn to the publishing world. I just wanted to make one more note of you talked about all of the writing rituals that you engage in, and it sounds like you meditate before you write, you light candles. I wanted to draw attention to that just because we're so inundated with distraction and email and social media and all of that as writers. And a way to quiet and silence sort of the external world so that you can enter this fictive world. And I thought it's a helpful idea for writers to physically go through acts of affirmatively silencing the external to turn inward. And I thought maybe you could say just another note or two on that, on kind of how you enter your writing space.
Yeah. So, you know, and I think right now, my gosh, the world is so crazy right now. And it's very, very difficult to access your inner world. And I just have great empathy for all of us trying to write in this particular time. And I won't pretend to you that I'm having an easy time with it right now. But I am able to do it sporadically, and that's the best I can hope for right now. But what I do is I have to do it early in the morning. I have to start the day off with that intention that I'm going to silence everything else except for the very private writing world that I am about to enter. So I will go into my writing room. I close the door. The animals are welcome. The dog and the cats are in there with me and they're welcome to stay. I close the door. I light candles. I ask the muses to help visit me. And I, you know, basically say to them, here is my pen. I'm handing it to you. And whatever images you'd like to give me today, I will gratefully receive. And I'm just going to sit here and be an open vessel. And please let me know what you'd like me to transcribe today. And so I just pretend that I have an army of people helping me to write. And I'll sit in silence. I'll close my eyes with my fingers above the keyboard. And when I feel like I've got an image, I'll open my eyes and start typing. And I might not get a great download that day. Again, sometimes it's only, you know, it's only a few paragraphs, or some days it'll be, you know, 10 pages. I mean, it just depends on how the images come, but I try not to edit. I try to just grab what comes to me, and I try to have faith that there's something in there that is guiding me towards story. So it is, you know, it's a little bit woohoo. I get it. It's sounds, but as I've explained to you, that's the world in which I live. And I embrace that world, and it's helped me very much. And particularly during this dark time, I find it helpful to escape there on the days I'm able to do that.
Well, and I really love that because it takes away a lot of the pressure. First of all, if you sit down and you're just staring at your cursor blinking at you, it's terrible. But also, it, you know, as you say, trying not to edit yourself, that's another layer, it seems like, of handing this over to something else and saying, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, just let it come. It doesn't overly matter what comes. You can worry about that later. Right. It just seems like a really great way to take the pressure off of yourself.
Well, that is true. And it does take the pressure off me. I don't worry. You know, it's funny, as much time constraints as I have put on my characters, for myself, I don't worry about time. Mm. So if I waste that session of writing, so what? You know, it's okay. Right. I'll forgive myself for having wasted that time if it turns out to be that. Or I'll trust myself that something positive came from that time I spent, even right. if it's nothing more than meditation. Right. So it is helpful. You know, I think we put too much pressure on ourselves with everything we do. You know, everything has to be perfect or great or on purpose. And it's just not true. It's a false belief.
So let's talk about publishing, because people are so eager to publish their books. And I think, you know, we make the point over and over on this show that if you're in it to make money or to, you know, have Random House's stamp of approval, you should move on, you know, that it's, yeah. that's not what it's about. But anyway, tell me a little bit about, you had a lot of success with the Dream Stitcher and awards. This book hasn't been out long enough to garner those yet, but I bet they're coming. So tell me a little bit about your decision to self-publish and that process, and then, you know, kind of how you went about winning awards in the aftermath of that.
So like every writer, I really, you know, dearly wanted to have a traditional publishing experience. That's what I wanted. But I also wanted to be an actor, and that didn't happen for me. So we don't get everything we want in life. And I tried what I thought was very hard to connect the dots to make that happen. And I couldn't make it happen. I tried for, I don't know, you know, maybe 5 or 6 years. And some people tell me that wasn't long enough. And I accept that there's opinion, that was their opinion. But because I come from a background of being an entrepreneur who then was a corporate exec, I am used to doing things myself. And I've never known anything else but just jump and making things happen. Because, you know, I can, and we all can. So when I was tired of living in rejection, which is how I felt I was living for a number of years, I would wake up every day, I would send out queries and nothing would come back, or something would come back, I'd say thank you very much with the form letter. And I just, at a certain point, didn't want to live that way anymore. It just wasn't healthy for me. I am very, very blessed, and I don't take it lightly, that I can afford to self-publish. And I mention that because not everybody can. And so I know that I am particularly blessed. But because I am, maybe that's why I didn't need to take up a spot for somebody else that, you know, that does need to stay the course and be in traditional publishing. So I just decided that I had enough faith in my own writing that I could have this journey in whatever way I could get it. And that's what I did. So I went forward, I found the best people I could find that could help me turn out a finished book. I found an editor that I had confidence in and someone that could help me with the production side of it. And I just went forward. I got very lucky with the Dream Stitcher because the National Jewish Book Awards happened for me. I just happened to enter a contest through the Jewish Book Council, and that's what happened. And that made the book take off. It would be lovely if that happens for Synchronicities on the Avenue of the Saints. I don't know, but I'm proud of the work, and I was proud of the Dream Stitcher. And I just decided that I had enough gumption to just go forward and do what I needed to do to make it happen. And the truth is, you have to do those same things if you're a traditional author. So I'm doing the same things that any author would have to do. I just decided to fund it myself. And I kind of looked at it as, you know, many, many years ago, Simon and Schuster were just, you know, two guys that got together that decided they knew literature. So why can't I decide that on my own, you know?
So I think that's a good point of telling people, once they have published, to continue submitting books to contests, other seals of approval, because you said, as you say, that really propelled it forward.
Right. Yeah. No, it does make a difference. I mean, at some point, you know, you know, look, at the work has to be good on its own. It doesn't matter whether it's traditionally published or not. It has to be good on its own. And you will find something that gives you that seal of approval. If the work is meant to find it. There's a lot of contests out there and there's a lot of ways to connect. So you just keep working it.
Tell me about the Indie Reader Discovery Award for Literary Fiction.
Yeah, so, I mean, again, that was just submitting it, and it's a year-long contest. You submit it to Indie Reader, they give you a rating, and then they keep measuring it against other books that they read in your genre over the course of the year. So, yeah, that was a nice surprise. That was just a kind of a nice little cherry on top of the whipped cream.
And the Dream Stitcher is in audio, and I know that was its own process as well, but I think audiobooks have a life of their own right now that are really important.
Yeah, so that, you know, I really, really wanted to make an audiobook. You know, I was an actor, and so for me, that was just kind of a bucket list that I just wanted to do it, and I'm really proud of the work, and it was great fun. It was very difficult. I won't sugarcoat it. There was nothing fun about recording that book. And it was a lot of, and I won't go into the whole story. It was, when I finally got the right people involved, it went very quickly, but that didn't happen until a year into the process of recording this book. It was just kind of a crazy combination of failures. But I am proud of the finished work. It was great fun. I could pretend I was Claire Danes. I'm not Claire Danes, by the way. She's much better, but it doesn't matter. And if nothing else, I just have this, you know, great thing that my great, great, great grandchildren, if they feel like listening to what, you know, crazy grandma sounded like, they can open the file of the audiobook. So, yeah, so it was fun to do. I really haven't made a decision yet whether I'm doing that with Synchronicities on the Avenue of Saints, and I don't know why. I have trepidation about recording that book, but I might have it made and not record it myself.
Well, now that you've found the right people to do it, it would be a shame to waste the resource that took you a long time to find.
But. That's true. That's true. But, I don't know. You know, it's funny. These are different characters, and it feels like more of a male book. So I'm not really sure that I'm the right person to record that. It just felt very natural for me to record the Dream Stitcher and not natural to record this. So there you go.
Is it harder now? Do you find marketing in the, you know, in the times we find ourselves in the pandemic than it was the Dream Stitcher?
Yes, it is. And I have to admit, I just am resisting it. I'm not finding it joyful to market at the moment. Or maybe I need to wait until January. I'm just very resistant to doing things that I know I need to be doing right now. And this is going to sound strange. I feel like I'm inserting myself into a conversation that I don't need to be in at the present moment. And so I'm just going to wait a little bit and start fresh after the first of the year. And I don't expect that to sound like good advice. It's terrible marketing advice. Don't listen to me. But it's just how I feel right now. And I feel like it's so muddled and dark out there. And I don't know how to enter that space.
Well, you raise a really good point, because I think, you know, the first threshold we thought of is, oh, all these literary events are getting canceled and you can't go to bookstore readings and you can't go to library readings. But really, as you're pointing out, the issue is more one of the discourses moved to something else in the public domain, and right. How do we fit into that? And
right,
I do take that point. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, I don't know what it is. It's just I feel that resistance I just feel that resistance. I'll leave it at that. And so yeah. I'm just going to wait a little bit. I figure the story will wait. It's okay.
Any last minute words of either publishing advice, writing advice, but self-publishing advice, anything that you've picked up along the way that has sustained you or helped you?
Well, let me say this to anyone that's, you know, on the journey in whatever way they find themselves on the journey. It is so important to stay the course. If nothing else, then writing for me has really improved my soul. It has changed me in ways that I couldn't have achieved without it. And if nothing else happens, if these two novels go down in history as, you know, small little gnats that didn't need to be out there, it doesn't matter. I feel changed as a result. And that fuels me to stay the course and keep on writing. And if you find that it's something else that helps transform your soul and elevate you, then do that. But it has been transformative and enlightening and such a gift that I'm really, truly grateful to have had the opportunity to be on this journey. And I don't want to stop to see what else I can come up with that might transform myself further.
The writing is the most important thing. Not the publishing.
Very little to do with it.
That has been the enduring theme. Deborah Gall, thank you so much. We can find you. You have a wonderful website, deborahgall.com. Gall's A-A-L, we should say, so people can find you.
Right, yes. It is not, I'm not a woman who has a lot of gall, G-A-L-L, so it's okay to get that spelling correct.
We will keep an eye out for you elsewhere on the internet. I mean, I do hope that some of these events resume and interviews resume, and so we can find you elsewhere out in the world as soon as things quiet down a little bit. So please keep pushing.
The world will quiet down. I have hope in the world. It's going to be okay. It will, and I will absolutely find ways to connect again. But thank you so much. This has just been a delight for me. I appreciate it.
That was Deborah Gall. The book Synchronicities on the Avenue of the Saints is out and available now. You can find it widely online. That's all the time we have for today. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.